with regard to certain mitzvos in the Torah. For example, in the verse which says that you shall not curse a deaf person. And in front of a blind person, you should not place a stumbling block. The second clause, that you shall not put a stumbling block in front of a blind person, can't be taken literally. That is to say, it's not telling us that you can't put an impediment, an obstacle, a banana peel in front of a blind person who's walking down the street, causing him to trip. Because that already is prohibited. And that has nothing to do with whether the person is blind or not. It is prohibited to place something in the public domain which can cause damage to others. It's the kind of thing, by the way, that people don't think about. It's an amazing thing that there are certain religious obligations or prohibitions that people pay a tremendous amount of attention to. And then there are others that are just as serious, if not more serious, and people don't tend to think that these are problems. Because you find glass. I go jogging, you'll always see glass, or people leave bottles. And very often I'll pick them up and then throw them in the garbage can because it's a stumbling block. Somebody drives by, they'll slash their tires on it. And somebody put it there. That kind of a thing, I believe that whatever the reason may be, when a person does that kind of thing, maybe they'll do it, maybe they won't do it, but they won't put it in the same framework, for example, as eating non-kosher food. That's something which is horrible. Who can you know, for a religious person. A religious person, that's that they'll take very seriously. But something like this, if they, for whatever reason, they had a lot of junk in the car and they had to get rid of it and they just threw it out or whatever it is, and the fact that they created that kind of a problem, that they don't stop and think, and maybe I'm violating something religiously over here. Let's express it a different way, because most decent people wouldn't deliberately do a thing like that. But there are people that do it. Like sometimes it may be kids that are out partying, because you see it, that, you know, they'll go, it's not just kids though, it's adults too, they'll leave beer bottles. Sometimes they don't care, sometimes they'll even, I maintain it's deliberate. It provides them with a certain type of a sick satisfaction, a sadistic type of phenomenon, which to me is reflective of a very sick moral disposition. Because I can understand there's different degrees of sinfulness. There are people steal, or people cheat. It's very wrong. It's wrong. But at least you can understand that they're motivated by, they're impelled. They think they're getting some benefit out of it. They're not just doing it. They're harming you. It's not right to harm someone else for your benefit, but at least you see what impels them. If there was nothing in it for them, they wouldn't be doing it. But here's a case where they derive nothing. They don't derive any benefit whatsoever, and such a disregard, a sheer delight in the fact that somebody else is going to suffer. That's what it seems to indicate to me. But let's put it in a different framework. What about a situation where accidentally something fell out of your bag, or you're driving, whatever, something fell out of the car, or you have a child and the child threw something out, and it, let's say it's glass, it breaks and it shatters on the sidewalk. Are you obligated to stop and to clean it up? That's a challenging situation. There are certain situations which challenge the religious consciousness of a person. A person looks at that differently. In the same way that there's serious obligation if you come upon a lost object. Person walking, you're going for a walk. It happens to me more frequently because I'm a jogger. So you jog, you know, you see things on the ground. So it happens from time to time that there are objects over there. So that's a whole question of law, what to do. Under what circumstances do you have an obligation to pick it up and try and return it? There are many questions involved. If it's something which clearly is identifiable, that is, you can find out who owns it, then the assumption is that the person did not give up hope, did not, you know, relinquish the object, and then there's an obligation to pick it up and to return it. But these types of things are the kind, these are real challenges to a person, because They're kind of bothersome, I'd say. They're bothersome kind of mitzvahs. For many reasons. The whole thing becomes a big annoyance. Most people have enough to do, and just taking care of their own stuff. And they certainly don't want to have to put themselves out and get involved in something which can be very tedious and waste their time for something which doesn't benefit them, which is really for somebody else, and that somebody else is a complete stranger. So there's very little personal satisfaction. It's interesting, in terms of the discussion, we've been talking a lot about chesed, about compassion, in the case of Rachav and what true compassion is, and so forth. The same is true in this type of a situation, where for one reason or another, something happened by accident. Something fell out of your car. But it does create a stumbling block. So there's a tremendous amount of a rationalization, a desire to just move on. That's the emotion. And you sort of like, you don't even think about it, you block it out, and you just keep moving, and by the time you may even start thinking about it, it's too late to go back. It's, you just want to get yourself out of that situation. You don't want to deal with it. Those are the emotions. So you see that people relate to different types of religious obligations. It's not so simple. I mean, people say a person's religious. A person can be very selectively religious. Religious in certain areas, but not religious in other areas. In this particular case, the Torah is teaching us a very important lesson. It says that in front of a blind person, you should not place a stumbling block. And the blind person over here is someone who is ignorant in an area and has come to you for guidance. So they're relying on you. And it could happen, and very, very often you do the best. Your obligation is to be honest and to give the person the best possible advice. But if there should be, you may have motivations in certain cases to mislead them for various reasons. This happens all the time, and you know that. This is for me, it becomes a major issue because we all experience it in different areas. I experience it a lot in phone calls about shidduchim, about matches. You know the whole shidduchim crisis today? So people inquire. Because today, a tremendous amount of investigation has to be done. You have to fill out a questionnaire. Anyways, other people will want my recommendation. They'll want to use my name as a recommendation for a school or for a job. But seriously, that happens to people. You can get that. I'm sure you've all been in that situation when people have asked you about a certain person that you know, and you may feel a certain amount of conflict over there. You may feel conflict over there. What do you do in a case like that? Where you're caught between two objectives. On the one hand, you like this person's a friend, and, you know, that's every Jew's ideal to make a match. You want to make a match, right? Everybody wants to be a matchmaker. Like that's the key. For some reason or other, that's like a big accomplishment. So you want to be the matchmaker. On the other hand, let us say that the person's asking questions, and if you're going to be completely honest in terms of answering those questions, then it could create problems. That is to say, you have information. You have information which could have a negative effect in terms of achieving the objective. It's not a simplistic thing. There's an old Yiddish expression, which I'm not even going to bother saying in Yiddish. I'm going to go right to the English. I'll say it in Yiddish. Aligen terminet zogen, und dem MS darf man nicht sagen. Translated, a lie you're not allowed to say, and the truth you don't have to say. Now that may sound like deception, but no, it depends how you use it. I think there is a truth in that, which is you don't always volunteer negative information. That's not your obligation. If I'm being interviewed for a job, which I think I'm qualified for, so it's one thing to be dishonest in my answer. But I don't have to, if I know that I have certain weaknesses, as we all do, in certain areas, I don't have to volunteer that. Unless I think it's going to come up anyways, maybe it's better if I bring it out in the first place, that might be the case. But I'm not obligated to do so. And I just have to answer their questions. If they don't ask those questions, and they hire me, and then later on they find out about these things, and they say, you know, had we known that, we wouldn't have hired you. I didn't do anything wrong. Because I wasn't being, it's not my obligation to tell the truth in a situation like that. Of course, there are cases where you cannot use that defense, where you do have an obligation. What would be the line of demarcation? When would that defense cease to be operative? In what situation would you be culpable for failing to disclose, for failing to reveal? I would say that if there's a universal kind of a situation, if it's a known thing, if you have a certain type of defect, which is assumed everybody, if they knew about this, would not hire you, and for whatever reason, they just didn't ask because they didn't assume it was there, but you knew it was there. The same would be true, for example, if you're selling a house, or you're selling a car, you're selling an item. So you have to be truthful. The person asks you questions. But let's say the house or the car had a very serious defect that if the person knew about it, would never buy it, but they just didn't happen to ask about it. Like the car just doesn't happen to have an engine, for example. They just assumed it was there. They didn't even bother to ask that one. Now, in that situation, that you're obligated to tell, because that's deception, the failure, because it's a known thing that nobody would buy a car. However, with regard to other things, there's many, many different things about a house. You know, when the sunshine comes, this factor, the other factor, I don't have to, you ask, and I don't know what's on your mind. I don't have to offer anything that I would consider to be a negative thing. That you find out, that you ask. If you ask, then I got to be truthful. With regard to people that ask information about somebody else, a reference, whether it be for a match, a shidduch, or for a job or anything, you are caught between those two restrictions, the prohibition against deception. You can't deceive the other person because you want to see someone else get a job, because then you're causing a harm to the person who hires him. And on the other hand, there's a prohibition against evil speech. You're not allowed to speak evil speech about the person, thereby harming that person. It's essential to be able to differentiate. You can't lie about a person. And in general, the only time I think you'd be obligated to indicate that there's a problem here is if it's something which would be serious, which would be a stumbling block. That is, if the person has some... In many cases, you have to use judgment. There are ways to communicate to people that they may have a problem with a certain thing without directly speaking about the other person. There's also differentiating between things that are pretty subjective and things that the person will find out on their own. Because everybody's got personality, everybody's got strengths, weaknesses, everybody gets angry from time to time and so on and so forth. That's not the job. You should avoid those kinds of things. That's not the job of a person when you're being asked for a recommendation to give a complete personality breakdown, character analysis. That's absurd. People that probe too far, I stop it. I try and instruct them in what's important to know and how much do you need to know. That's another problem today with the whole approach, is that for some reason or other, the kinds of questions that people ask, in my opinion, border on the absurd, and I'll point it out in a nice way. That there's a certain amount that's essential for starters, that the people will get to know each other and they'll see. Before they even had one date, it's as though you have to know everything that there is to know about this person. It's like taking something and going to a crazy kind of an extreme. However, if there is something that is hidden and dangerous, you know, prior arrests, a prison record, you know, something of that type of a situation. Health problems, for example, if you know that a person has a disease, which the person is very good at covering up. And then you're in a really, you have a really big problem over here, because the failure to disclose would be a stumbling block before a blind person. There's a situation. Or let me, however, make it even more challenging. Because as long as you're dealing with extremes, it becomes a little easier to deal with. Obviously, the more serious the defect, the problem, the easier it is to say, well, this I have to reveal. Can't keep this a secret. However, let's say it's a friend of yours that you care deeply about. And this is where the problems are really going to emerge, where they're not that clear-cut, the gray areas. And you have faith in this person. You think this person is a good person. But you know that, objectively speaking, there's some problems over there. And other people might not look at it that way. And this person turns to you for advice. And you give your advice, and you're very good at convincing. You're trying to make a case to convince the person that everything will be okay. Is that an issue of, before a blind person, you may not place a stumbling block? These types of situations, blind person, stumbling block, can occur in different ways. For example, as a school, you have a school. Let's take our school. Let's take Masoret. Let's take the yeshiva. When people express interest. Now, the natural reaction of every administrator in a school who's involved in recruitment or administration and so forth, prospective students, is to go out and say, this is the greatest school. This is where you ought to be. That's, you're selling the school. You're a salesperson. Well, if you're a salesperson, you could have this challenge too. Because salespeople don't just describe the product abstractly. But you're doing more than that. You're trying to talk the person into buying it. Make the investment that it's really terrific for you. Now, is that another expression of putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person? Let's differentiate. The question is being raised that someone saw in front of a carpeting store a sign saying, we've sold more carpets than anywhere, that type of a thing. Which, when you analyze it logically, you know, so what? Maybe you sold more bad carpets, more shoddy carpets. You know, that doesn't really prove anything. I would say, however, that if that's all we're saying, limiting it just to that, that making a claim about your product. Let's say your product is used by more people in whatever category. The other question would be, is it true or is it false? If it's false, it's a lie. Now, to say that. If it's true, you've got the statistics. The research shows that you're, what is it, like McDonald's? They sold like 20 billion burgers, whatever it is. So for whatever that means, if it's true, that, I maintain, is perfectly legitimate advertising. Because whether or not that's relevant is your decision. You have to presuppose that the customer has free will, and you're allowed to, so to speak, hawk your product to draw attention to your product, as long as you're being honest about it. With regard to advertising, a different technique that's used, that is to say that they're selling a fantasy. They're not selling the product per se. In most advertisements for cars, you see how glamorous it is. You never see ordinary-looking people. You see glamorous people, always beautiful people. And the person who bought this car has the most beautiful woman with him. And looking, gazing, he's like the most wonderful thing in the world. Just because he went out and bought a car. Can you imagine? It's that easy. And I assume it works. You know, products that are geared towards women, I'm sure they pretty much do the same thing. So now the question arose, is that legitimate, seeing as how the Rambam goes to such an extreme about Gnevas Das, theft of information, theft of knowledge, deceiving, that type of phenomenon. So in discussing that, it led us to a discussion of advertising. The reason why cigarettes were so successful in advertising, the so-called Marlboro Man, Like the Marlboro Man was this guy, kind of horse, this cool guy riding off into the sunset. Well, I mean, the irony is that it depicted all these supposedly healthy things, smoking a cigarette, which is not the most healthy thing. But it sold. You see the power of advertising. Oh, yeah. It definitely worked. Advertising per se is not enough to be successful. Just the greatness of the advertising is not going to determine the success of a product. The product has to have something. Because let's say you're brilliant at getting people to purchase something the first time around, and it turns out to be really horrible. I don't think they're going to keep buying it because you're advertising so. Because then reality sets in. People do have a reality principle. However, given that your product, the fact that you have a great product in and of itself is not going to guarantee success either. Because there are two elements. There's the product and there's the market. And business, the objective of business is to get the product to the market. So advertising is the bridge between the two. And sometimes advertising creates the market. You know, it doesn't just discover it, it creates the market. But that's what they're doing over here. See, in America, that's the idea. In America, the advertising is doing more than simply bringing the product to your attention. It's creating the market, in a sense. And that's why it involves this fantasy. Because a person may have a perfectly good functional car, but then they see this picture, this advertisement, and it creates a certain longing because it arouses the fantasy within them, and now they don't look at it realistically anymore. So while they don't really have any objective need for the product because they already have one, but the fantasy is aroused by advertising. That's what advertising does. It arouses your hunger. It arouses the desire. It doesn't just bring something to your attention. That's why it's always connected to some ideal kind of situation. Something that, a piece of furniture, so it's going to be presented in the context of this beautiful dream house. That's what it's selling you. It's selling you that fantasy, that you partake of that. Anyways, I still maintain, however, that I don't think that this would be a violation, halakhically. It's not false advertising. It is not false advertising. It's true that the concept is false, but they can sell their car, they could depict it, they could have someone driving it, they could have someone who's a model, who's the most handsome or beautiful looking person, whatever you want to say, and there's no lie over there, there's no overt lie, and no intelligent person will maintain, will any intelligent person maintain that they bought the car thinking that as a result of buying it, they're going to become a playboy and all the girls are going to be flocking to them? No one's going to make that claim. It's just because consciously they're not thinking that. It's appealing to something in the unconscious. So now you may decide, if you're on a very high level of perfection, you may personally decide that you don't want to manipulate people's emotions that way. You don't want to be involved in that. But if you're talking practically speaking, that's not a lie. I don't think that there's a... That's the kind of thing where you're leaving the customer. The customer has to use their intelligence as well. So as long as I didn't mislead you, I didn't mislead you. I didn't tell you that this is going to solve your problems. That just buy this car and that's it. Everything's going to go smoothly. I didn't tell you that. And everybody knows it's just a commercial. Everybody knows that. Now the rest is up to you. If you decide to go ahead with this fantasy or whatever the case may be, that's your problem. You have to exercise your intelligence. There's individual responsibility. However, if I lie to you, I owe you. That's something I owe, the truth to you. Then I've harmed you because since you've exercised your intelligence on the basis of the false information, you've come to a false conclusion. That's placing a stumbling block before somebody who's blind. Getting back to our situation. There are many cases in life where it's not a question of being dishonest in terms of the facts. It's very rare that you walk into the perfect situation and it's that clear and it's that obvious. In most situations in life, there's different elements, either business or marriage or with a particular individual, you're not 100% clear. Because there's good things and bad things and you can't make a decision. So you ask for guidance. when you give the guidance and you convince, the case we're talking about is where you're aware that this person has certain faults, but this person is connected to you, maybe you're a brother or sister, a sibling, or maybe a close friend, and you really very much want them to have this opportunity, and you use all of your persuasive abilities with the other person who trusts you to convince that person to come to this conclusion, as opposed to the other conclusion. The conclusion, that is to say, which is favorable to the thing that you, the outcome that you want. Is that a matter of, before a blind person, you may not place a stumbling block? If we go back to the verse, the very next phrase is, V'yareisa me'alokecha ani et Hashem, and you shall fear your God, I am the Lord. And of course the question is, what does that have to do with this? What's the connection? And Rashi explains that it's precisely, of course every command is based on the fear of God. If you didn't have the fear of God, you wouldn't keep any command. So it doesn't say after every command that you shall fear God. That is a different aspect of the fear of God. Of course, the foundation of all the commandments is the recognition of God and the fear of God. However, there are different types of fear of God. There are cases where a person has the ability to hide certain things, even from themselves, to rationalize things, and to maintain that they were acting in the person's best interests. There are certain mitzvos which challenge you in that area. That is to say, a higher level of perfection. That is, it's not going to say you shouldn't steal and you shall fear God. Because no one's going to, a person is stealing, he's stealing. He's going to know that he's stealing. He's not going to deceive himself. When a person breaks into somebody's house and steals, it's of course he's lacking in fear of God. Fine. It's obvious from that the very act defines him as being someone who's lacking in the fear of God. So there's no need to say in that place, and you shall fear God. But over here, it's possible for a person to violate the stumbling block prohibition and still maintain that he fears God. That's why you have to emphasize it over here, because you can deny it. Because there are certain things, as Rashi says, that are given over to the heart. That nobody else will ever know. You can defend yourself. You gave this advice, didn't work out. People may say afterwards, and you explain all the factors, you explain all the arguments, and nobody can pin it on you. You can say, look, my intention was for the person's best interest. I didn't know. I advised them. At that point in time, the stock market was going well, and this was better, and this is what I did. However, the motivations can be very well camouflaged, can be very, very well hidden. It could be in the case we're talking about that your advice that you gave is very, very reasonable. But what motivated you to give it? Deep down, given that there were different factors over here, and you can make a case for this, you can make a case for that, was your own personal desire the determining factor? Did it play a role in determining the outcome that you would come to? Your own personal desire, and having said that, then it's easy to say, no, it was the objective. Objectively speaking, you can make a case. There's no question you can make a case. But this person is a blind person, and you reached a certain conclusion on the basis of a personal benefit, which was not necessarily in the best interest of the person. So there are cases where it's a very subtle phenomenon, where it's very, very easy to avoid having to acknowledge that that's what you did. That's why I think the practically speaking, when you're involved in a situation like that, if you're someone who has a tremendous amount of insight, which is not easily attained, that is to say that you have the ability to take up an issue in which you are subjectively involved and treat it objectively. That's a significant level of advancement. That is to say, for example, if it was something about yourself, somebody had a criticism about you, and you were able to listen, absorb it, and look at it purely objectively and acknowledge that it was true, if it is true, or if it's not, but at least to hear it through and to show why it's not defensive. Or someone is talking about your child, where the natural instinct is to defend the child, especially with something significant. And you have the ability to be completely objective in a dispute between your child and somebody else and to come to the conclusion that the other child is right. If you have that type of an ability, then, to isolate, to recognize that you have the emotional desire, it's your friend or it's your brother or sister, whatever it is, and you have the ability, once you recognize it, to factor it out and treat the matter purely objectively and come to an objective decision, so then you're okay. But if you don't, or you're not sure, which is probably the best advice, when cases like that come up, then it's what a judge has to do. Whenever a judge, and the law is very demanding about this, by the way, I think that's not a bad example to follow. Because there is a danger in relying on what I just said. A person might overestimate themselves. And that, too, can be a result of your own self-interest. You can overestimate yourself and say, I can be very objective on this. When, in point of fact, maybe you're not. The law is that a judge has to recuse himself. If he has any kind of a relationship, any kind of an involvement with the case, that is one of the parties. If one of the parties is your friend, and so on and so forth, then you must recuse yourself. And the rabbis in the Talmud give examples of how extreme one ought to be in considering the factor of self-interest. To the extent that this Talmud cites cases of a rabbi that recused himself. Why? Because one time he was passing through the city and this person opened up the door for him, showed respect for him, something which would seem to be trivial. Not money, there's no bribery. You'd think it's a small thing. He happened to visit a town and this person showed him some respect. And now that's a couple of years ago. So now this person's in his own courtroom. It means to say that such is the power of the unconscious that immediately you're drawn to that person. That's how we are. If people show us some kind of favor, some kind of respect, we like them. That's a good person. It's a purely subjective response. You know, objectively, maybe the person's a bad person, but that's how we are. To that extent, he was afraid that even unconsciously, that would give him a certain predisposition, a certain favor towards that person's case. You mean to say he couldn't be objective anymore? It's showing you the extent to which a person has to be concerned in terms of honesty, especially if you're a judge, because that's justice, the administration of justice. Now, whether or not you have to be that demanding in a case like this is a question, but I would say that you should be demanding. That if you sense that emotion, the emotional pull, that you desire a certain outcome, because you know how it is, very often questions arise, and immediately you desire a certain outcome. You have this all the time. It could be in a marriage. You know, should we go here this summer? Should we do that? Should we do the other thing? And one of those things kicks off a certain emotion within you. So then you don't let on, but you know, you start to argue. You start to argue and garner all the reasons why that's because you're attracted to that outcome. That's the outcome you want. Once that's the outcome you want, then the mind goes to work to justify it. See, if that is the case, if you sense in yourself that that's the outcome that you desire, then I would disqualify myself. Unless you make it very clear to the other person and say, I'll be very honest with you, I really want this match to happen, and I'm very prejudiced. If you still want to hear my thoughts as to what the case would be, then you have a right to do it. But I'm telling you right now, you should listen to other people as well. And that's what the person in many, like we raised the issue before, an administrator in a school is always going to sell you a school. I think that comes up very frequently. And this is among religious people, because a lot of rabbis are always trying, you know, that's part and parcel of having a yeshiva, having a school. You always want to recruit. Now, if you're going to recruit, you can try and convince that person why this is the best place for them. In my opinion, you're not allowed to do that. You have to consider what's the best for that person. And if the person has a different alternative, and objectively speaking, that person would gain more in a different school, that's your competitor, so then you have an obligation to tell them that. That's why it says, V'yareisa me'alekecha, that you shall fear the Lord, because that's the ultimate element that a person always has to have before them. With regard to everything that they do, after all is said and done, you know, because you've been able to convince people and you've been able to move people over and so on and so forth, then you have to stop and think, because these people don't know you, no one can read your mind. Then you have to think, what about the one that could read my mind? What about in the eyes of God? That fear of God in a situation where the social reality, in terms of the social context, there's no problem. But then you shall fear the Lord. That is this thing correct in the eyes of God? That's what the pasuk is teaching, because in this situation is where it's manifest. But in terms of your overall perfection, that's the real test. To develop that ability, that no matter what the situation is, and there are cases where a person can get away with a lot of things, and even if he didn't initiate them, things may happen. But there are factors over there which would require you to reveal the truth. That's the situation. For those situations in life where there's no practical pressure or force which would help you to go on the right path, which would force you, which would coerce you. Because, as I said, when it comes to theft, there's plenty of obstacles in your way. Doesn't have to say, forget about the fear of God, you don't want to get caught, your reputation, you'll go to jail, etc. It's a whole different ballgame. That does not require, in and of itself, the highest degree of fear of God. There's many other factors. And most of the things you want to get away with, there's other factors too. You'll get caught. You'll be the scum. You're lying, or you'll be found out. But there are situations where there's virtually impossible for you to be found out. So there's no pressure at all anymore. There's no social pressure. There's only one thing. It's the internal perfection of the realization that everything you do is known to God. And that's the ultimate objective, the relationship with God. That's what the Torah is teaching.